Welcome, everyone, to Street and Curb. I'm your host, Steve Carvelli. We're here every week at this time, and we discuss topics of the day and how they affect us as individuals, as a country, and as a people. Today, we're going to have an interesting question to answer, and I'm hearing this from both sides of the aisle, Republicans and Democrats, saying that this election is the election that really determines the fate of our democracy. Is democracy really at stake? Both parties seem to indicate that the other party represents existential threats to the democracy itself. So these are heavy questions that we have to answer. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Think your child might have swallowed the wrong medication, gotten into your household products, had a reaction to a bite or a sting? Call the Poison Helpline first for fast, free advice from medical professionals. Call 1-800-222-1222 anytime, anywhere. Save the number. Save a life. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Welcome back, everyone, to Street and Curb. As I mentioned earlier, we're going to talk about the question of democracy. Is it at stake at this election? Are there existential threats to our democratic way of life? So let's look at the situation here and see what potential threats could be. Well, of course, if you look at democracies over history, the threats include authoritarian rule that eliminates democracies. Democratically elected governments are overthrown on a rather routine basis in which a military tribunal takes over, and they claim that it's in the form of democracy that they have to correct. Another form of democracy that could affect us, or a change that could affect democracy, is changing the Constitution. And we are seeing some indications that people of both parties, primarily Joe Biden, wants to change the Constitution to reflect a, quote, reform. That is a potential issue for our democracy. The third issue is a return to power of someone who comes into power and then eliminates the democratic processes once in power. That would be like an authoritarian rule or an authoritarian taking power. And the last is electing an actor that generally doesn't want to leave. And of course, you know, there's a lot of talk about that Donald Trump, if he wins the election again, he will not leave in the subsequent 4 years when his first cycle is up. So we have a lot to discuss, and I wanted to talk about the first issue, and that is that how democracy has been affected and who wanted to change it. And a really classic example is the Electoral College. The Electoral College has been under review, has been under attack, especially since the last election. But let's discuss the Electoral College and how that affects democracy. The Electoral College, as you may know, was instituted by the Founding Fathers as really a compromise before the direct election of the president versus a congressional election of the president. So this was the compromise that the Founding Fathers came up with. And the Electoral College is this, that electors are based on each state. Each state has electors, and they depend on the latest census of the population. So they get an elector for each member of the Congress and the two senators. So there's 538 total electors and 270 to elect the president. Why did this happen? Why did they bring the Electoral College in? Well, they wanted to enhance the value of smaller states and the voters of smaller states and take the tilt away from large state urban centers. It's to kind of like balance the platform a little bit. Now, most times the Electoral College mirrors the popular vote. U.S. is the only democracy, and this is an interesting fact, it's the only democracy to use the Electoral College. All the other democracies that had a semblance of the Electoral College have eliminated it, terminated it, or revised it. But, you know, since over the last 200 years, there's been 700 proposals to reform or eliminate the United States Electoral College that is presented to Congress. And obviously not one has passed. So again, we go to the fact that, can this really upset the balance of democracy? The Founding Fathers started a country. They were leaving an authoritarian monarchy bloodline rule of England. And they had this in mind, is to protect the democracy and protect the value of voters in less populated areas. You know, as Ronald Reagan said, America is the democracy that is the beacon on the hill. It's a democracy that has a world presence, and it's always subject to how people interpret what this is. But the founding fathers actually thought that this was a blended approach that somehow compromised all parties involved when the country was founded. So it's interesting that the Electoral College is still under attack today. Democrats, especially progressive Democrats, want to eliminate the Electoral College. They want to go by popular vote only. Republicans do not want to eliminate the Electoral College. But if you're a strict constitutionalist, it's very difficult to pass anything without having two-thirds majority of all the states approve. And I don't think Electoral College is really the battle that we should be waging. If there is a major discrepancy between the Electoral College and the popular vote, maybe we could revisit it. I don't think that we should be changing the Constitution for Electoral College. Now, another aspect that I wanted to go over a little bit, Electoral College being the first one, is that Joe Biden, and I'm going to really use more examples on the Democratic side today because I think they're more prevalent than what we see on the Republican side, but they are on both sides. Both parties do it. Donald Trump does it. Joe Biden does it. But I want to talk about what some of the things that have been done recently that seem to have a greater effect on the democratic process. I guess when Joe Biden withdrew his nomination, he did a speech. It was really a political speech because it looked like he was running for office because he was touting a lot of his issues that he wanted to go over. But he actually wanted to do something that could be considered an existential threat to the democracy. Number one is that the entire primary process on the Democratic side was kind of thrown out the door. It was left to the street, as they say, because he appointed or he anointed Kamala Harris to be the nominee for the Democratic Party. It's interesting, and I can quote from his speech. And this is a quote. In just a few months, the American people would choose the course of America's future. I made my choice. I made my views known. I would like to thank our great Vice President Kamala Harris. She's experienced. She's tough. She's capable. She's an incredible partner to me and a leader of our country. Now the choice is up to you, the American people. It's an interesting paragraph because now the choice was up to him to choose the candidate. The primary process didn't exist. There wanted to be some parties wanted to have a shortened primary process, which in turn did not happen. So the president pretty much appointed his successor. And now he leaves it up to the American people to make the choice. It's interesting. Existential threats to democracy come from all sides. It comes when primary votes aren't counted. It comes when votes are marginalized. And it also comes when people appoint successors. But also, Biden, at the conclusion of his speech, he makes an argument on his role and how the overreaching concepts of and how he utilized the overreaching concepts of the founding fathers. And it's interesting. And I'm going to quote the last paragraph of his speech. The great thing about America is here is kings and dictators do not rule. The people do. History is in your hands. The power is in your hands. The idea of America lies in your hands. We have just to keep faith, keep the faith, and remember who we are. We're the United States. Nothing, there's simply nothing beyond our capacity when we do it together. So again, he says, let's act together, preserve our democracy. God bless you all and God protect our troops. What does he mean by preserve our democracy? Does it mean to vote in general? Because he kind of minimized the primary vote when he appointed Kamala Harris. Does he mean to vote Democratic? Does he mean to vote for Kamala Harris? So again, these terms of preserving our democracy, of being able to legitimize actions that somehow may undermine our democracy and prevent other people from undermining our democracy are really going to become a buzzword today and a buzzword in this election cycle. It's interesting that there's several examples, and I'm going to go in the second break here. It's, you know, where does democracy stand today? Are we threatened by outside parties, or are we more threatened by the internal bickering of our parties? So we're going to take a quick break. We're going to look at some more examples and see where we go from here. You know, we're months away from the election, but the fun is just beginning. So sit tight. We'll take a quick break.
Heart attacks and strokes don't stay home. When seconds count, call 911. The hospital is the safest place to be. Visit heart.org/don't die of doubt. Brought to you by the American Heart Association.
Welcome back, everyone, to Street and Curb. I'm your host, Steve Carvelli, and today's topic is democracy. What are the existential threats? Are there threats to our democracy, and do they come from the internal or the external forces that affect us? One of the other issues that I think, I'm choosing Joe Biden because he just had three major examples of how he thought the democracy was being threatened, but actually the threat is actually coming from him. And one of the latest things that he's going to do as a lame duck, he came up with a lame initiative to, quote, reform, unquote, the Supreme Court. Reform means term limits to him. The founding fathers expressly wanted to separate and insulate the judiciary from the executive and legislative branches. This is why they had terms for life. They were not to be under the influence of political people who come and go. But it's also, he's interested in reform for the Supreme Court and term limits, where the only other term limits we have in our government is the president and vice president. Senators stay on forever, it seems. Representatives can stay on forever. It's an interesting concept that term limits are going to be applied to the judiciary by an action of the executive branch. Now, let me remind you that how the Supreme Court has worked for over 250 years since the Constitutional Convention. So I'm not sure what reform is needed now and whether Joe Biden in the last 2 or 3 months of his presidency here as a lame duck now makes himself a champion of reform of the Supreme Court. Now, just on the face of it, it looks like a solution to a problem that the left or the progressive left of his party has devised. It's somehow to placate the mass of voters who feel that the Supreme Court rulings lately have been a problem, and they want to make corrections to that. Now, this is the same Joe Biden who actually considered packing the Supreme Court by adding more members to the Supreme Court. So generally, if you can add more members, you can change the ideological makeup of the Supreme Court and, of course, dilute the, quote, conservative influence that the Supreme Court supposedly has. So again, I'm going to ask, you know, does the problem with democracy and the threat to democracy come from something like this in which we change the Constitution, we change the aspect of the founding fathers separating the executive from the judicial branch? And do we allow the executive branch to have that much control and that much change to the judiciary? This is a Supreme Court. This should not be subject to any type of executive branch interference. It's worked for 250 years. The founding fathers actually, I thought, were much smarter for their time. And I think what they say is much relevant today, even with the change of circumstances and the change of society. But it's interesting because this is not the only issue with the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court issued a ruling about the immunity case of Donald Trump. And the media and the president have taken this as a call to arms to reform the Supreme Court also. The immunity case really involves official acts. Now, the Supreme Court ruled that official acts are protected and the president cannot be held accountable for official acts while in office. Now, what's interesting is they never define what official acts are. The official act definition is to be determined by other courts. However, Joe Biden and his progressive entourage seem to indicate that this is basically allowing a president to have unlimited powers. It has nothing to do with unlimited powers of the president. It merely defined and capitulated that official acts have to be defined, but they're not defining them. But official acts are covered under presidential immunity. And we would expect that. So the fight is with what is the definition of official acts, not that presidents are going to be allowed to do whatever they want, whenever they want, because there's no accountability. That is exactly opposite of what the Supreme Court said. Now, another aspect that this has happened earlier in the year, is the Roe versus Wade override by the Supreme Court. Again, the Supreme Court did not codify abortion. They kind of uprooted the precedent of Roe v. Wade. But they also stated that the subject of abortion is going to be sent back to the states for their decision. and for their accountability of their constituency for adjudicating that decision. So again, the Supreme Court pushed it back to the states to decide and did not say that it was not allowed anywhere, but they refused to codify it as part of the Constitution. Of course, Joe Biden and his progressive entourage seemed to indicate that they were against reproductive rights and that they were taking away rights of people that were already given to them. Tend to disagree with that. They wouldn't codify in the Constitution. I don't think it's a protected issue of the Constitution, but they did not deny the right. They said it's the state's rights to determine those type of issues. But again, you know, it was a reason for Joe Biden to make an issue and make a claim that the Supreme Court has outlived its functionality, outlived its usefulness to the democracy, and needed to be changed. So there are multiple issues on the Joe Biden side that seems to indicate that he uses the executive power to do a lot of things. He also, and let's not forget this, the Supreme Court struck down the forgiveness of student loan debt. But Joe Biden has continuously used executive action to eliminate debt for certain people, which in turn has been struck down again. But again, he has violated a cardinal tenet of the judiciary that the rule of law is paramount and everyone has to follow the rule of law. Joe Biden uses that no one's above the rule of law, but he uses executive order as president to compromise, to undermine the rule of law of the Supreme Court. I guess it's not good to be a conservative Supreme Court member now under the Joe Biden administration because the changes that they're proposing pretty much changes the founding father aspect and viewpoint of where the Constitution and how the separation of powers is. So in this case, the democratic process is actually eroding from within. So again, where do we stand in regards to the threat to democracy? I've always thought that the biggest threat to any democratic nation comes from within. It stands with people who are in power, who want to remain in power, and use certain aspects of law, certain interpretations of case study to further their ambition to remain in power and prevent the opposition from gaining power. You know, when you look at issues in which it suppresses voters, and that is a bad thing in itself, and that's always talked about by both parties of voter suppression, but it's also an issue of opposition suppression. And, you know, the threat to our democracy, this existential threat, we don't really have to look for a foreign power to invade our country and turn us to an authoritarian state. We just have to look inside and look at our politicians. And this is something that we really have to be aware of. You know, you have something that's going on in Venezuela right now. You have a socialist who was elected president of the country. Now that the policies have been put in place, a minor majority or a very slim majority now feels that that is not the pathway to go. And you have a contested election. And now we have riots and threats and everything going with Venezuela. But again, it's a situation that Maduro was elected to office. He was a socialist. He inputted some of his programs. The programs have fallen in disfavor. The economic response has not been what was promised to the people, and they want out. And again, it's someone in power who really doesn't like the democratic process, is using the democratic process to get in office, and now wants to change the rules of the game once in office. We've seen this before. You've seen this in Weimar Germany, going over to Nazi Germany. You see every democratically elected person who wants to change democracy and is authoritarian use the power of the position that they were elected in to make things difficult for everyone else. And history repeats itself. And unfortunately, I think that the mirror is on the United States for this election cycle. So again, where does democracy decline start? It starts from within. And it starts with our elected officials. And we have to speak up and we have to call the shots as we see it. And we have to protect our way of life, protect the democracy as the founding fathers envisioned it. They were smart people. And I think that their lasting impression kind of lasts through time. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back. I'm going to talk a little bit about a milestone that just passed us that really no one has even talked about. We'll take a quick break.
Think your child might have swallowed the wrong medication, gotten into your household products, had a reaction to a bite or a sting? Call the Poison Helpline first for fast, free advice from medical professionals. Call 1-800-222-1222 anytime, anywhere. Save the number. Save a life. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
It's pouring rain. It's real dark outside. Your heart starts beating really, really fast. You've never done anything so hard in your life. This is boot camp. This is the real thing now. It's such extreme pain, you don't understand how you can finish. I began to feel that there was no way I was ever gonna have my title, U.S. Marine. It takes special inner strength, courage, and desire to do this. I was just thinking, I'm so close. And when I finished, I was like, I'm done. I did it. The moment I will never forget is when this drill instructor that I admire so much comes up to me straight in front of me, put her arm on my shoulder and said, good morning, Marine.
PFC Summer Volkman became a Marine. Can you? Visit Marines.com or call 1-800-MARINES. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Welcome back, everyone, to Street and Curb. I'm your host, Steve Carvelli, and we just left a heavy topic about the existential threats to our democracy and how probably we should really pay attention to our elected officials and even our opposition officials about how they view democracy and what they view about the limitations of power. The separations of the executive, legislative, and judicial branch are paramount to our country and paramount to the success of this country and the sustainability of our way of life. So be careful and be aware and pay attention, people. We're in for a wild ride in this election cycle. I wanted to comment briefly about something that a milestone that has passed that really got a very little fanfare, unless you were up in New York and you looked at the deficit clock. On July 26th, the debt of this country passed $35 trillion. That means every American, 340 million plus of us, would take $103,834 out of our pockets to pay that off. That's every American, grandparents, parents, kids, infants, toddlers, Gen Z, Gen X, whatever it may be, that's everybody. Now, if you limit it to just taxpayers, which basically is the only way this government is funded, it amounts to $260,404 per person to pay off the debt right now. Now, I remind you, the debt is growing every minute of every day. So that number is going up even as this show is going on. So in 4th of January of this year, the debt was $34 trillion. It took 7 months to add $1 trillion. And June of 2023, it was $31.46 trillion. So all of this has moved up $4 to $5 trillion since the beginning of the year. Now, the debt represents 122% of our gross domestic product. The general consensus is when that number goes above 90%, it's considered a no growth zone. We are above that by 32%. It's interesting that when you have a situation of a national calamity, state of war, the housing crisis in 2008, COVID to some extent, that the government would spend more money than it's taking in to keep the country going. It did it after COVID, in the major economic upheaval of 2008, it did, the banking crisis, it did, and during a war, the government would spend more than it's taking in because we have to win the war. But this $35 trillion that this country is built on debt and not on equity is going to be a big problem because interest rates going up means we have to pay more money to service the debt, which means less money going to the programs that are out there. So the issue here is, you know, what are we going to do about the debt? The issue here is really one on spending. We are like people, drunken sailors on leave, who keep spending over and over again on policies and pork policy, let's say, to help particular constituencies. It is unfortunate, but it looks like, on the face of it, that deficit spending is a way of people in power spending money on programs that pretty much bolster up their support, their voting support, or affect a certain class of people that they need to get the voting support for. So in other words, it's used as a voting mechanism, a voting energizer is to spend money. Student loan debt relief, the Inflation Reduction Act, the projects of building infrastructure, nice in design. However, their effect is contributing to the multi-trillion dollar debt that continues to saddle this country. Now, remember, a lot of the debt is owned by foreign entities, China being one. So we have our foreign company and foreign countries that are not necessarily our friends, but are our economic partners in the debt of this country. So again, this has been a milestone. 26 July is probably a day that we should always remember, that $35 trillion this country owes, and we have no functional pathway to pay that down, unless we have a severe austerity cut. So again, here at Street and Curb, we want to bring you up to date with certain aspects of facts that may get buried under the pressure of higher headlines and more pertinent news. But again, the $35 trillion threshold was passed on 26 July. And if history holds us right, we're going to pass that again in 7 months to $36 trillion. Not good news, people. We need to act on it. So we're running out of time here on Street and Curb. And again, I ask you to join us next week. And let me leave you these parting words. Look to the left, look to the right, before you jump off that curb and into the street. That's what we talk about here at Street and Curb. We'll see you next week, same time, same channel. Be safe, be sure, and pay attention, because if you don't, it may be your country to lose. We'll see you next week. It's a beautiful